Hi everyone, it's Jody. Welcome back to Mommy Brain Revisited. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Danielle Stolzenberg, a professor at UC Davis and the founder of 51 Foundation. We talk about a recent paper she has out in a new model of perinatal mental illness in mice. We also talk about her foundation and the importance of studying females for biomedical research. As always, enjoy. Also, if you would like to learn more about the parental brain, you can listen to the other episodes, but also read my book, Mommy Brain. It's out in English and in French, and please do get in touch if you have any questions.
Sounds dry.
Question always is, how did you become interested in studying parenthood, motherhood, the parental brain?
Yeah, so it's funny what we were just talking about a second ago, because I was not interested in the maternal brain or the parental brain or pregnancy or reproduction really at all. You know, as a student, I was really interested in psychology and mental health, and I was always sort of focused on understanding the hows and the whys. And as soon as I realized that, you know, we could approach those things from a biological perspective, I got really excited. I always want to sort of drill down and understand mechanisms. And so, what I thought I would end up researching would be like motivation or learning, because those were the things that I was really interested in. But I wasn't super, as much as I was interested in those ideas, the way they were being approached in, the neuroscience world was less interesting to me. And so I feel like it was very serendipitous. Like, I got really lucky, and I learned about maternal behavior. And from the moment I learned about maternal behavior in rats, I was just completely fascinated. Because as you know, like for female, but actually for most mammals, females are not particularly interested in infants or offspring, sometimes really even aggressive towards them before they've birthed their own. And then there's this like dramatic. I mean, I just can't imagine a greater motivational change in adulthood. And I've always been really interested in adults. So this idea that, you know, you've experienced development, everything is solidified, but yet you can change so much, and you're doing so in this relatively sort of stable neuronal context. And that to me is really fascinating. So thinking about this idea that this, you know, it's like, literally, it's an overnight change in rats, right? Because it's like 24 to 48 hours before they give birth. And all of a sudden now, every piece of their being is devoted and dedicated to making sure that their offspring survive. Rat moms will cross an electrified grid to reach their pups. And this was just fascinating to me. So I think, you know, I don't have children, and I'm not personally interested in maternal care, but I think that I've come to understand it as a fascinating scientific phenomena. I think it also really intersects with so many other fascinating aspects of neuroscience, experience-dependent change, thinking about these dramatic hormonal fluctuations that change the way that, we perceive smell, for example, and things like that. So, so there's just a lot in there. And so my graduate student interviews, you know, I was introduced to the idea and I just never looked back.
That's awesome. Yes, a late convert, perhaps, right. But with much enthusiasm.
True.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe, I don't have this question on the list, but I'm wondering, like, tell us maybe about some of your like main findings then from your research over the years before we delve into this one paper.
Sure. Yeah. Let me think. One of my biggest interests over the years of my career has really been understanding the role of hormones, but really the role of no hormones. So maybe that's not the best way to put it, but sort of, you know, trying to understand how do organisms become emancipated from hormonal control, right? So we know that hormones play this huge role in maternal motivation and, you know, they facilitate mother-infant bonding, but we also know that you don't necessarily need hormones. Like we think, can think about human women, right? Or parents adopting children, or non-birthing parents still being involved in raising young and being incredibly motivated to care for infants. And so that piece always really fascinated me. So even from my early graduate work with rats who are so dependent on hormones really to interact with infants, they really need them to sort of transition from that, like, I am completely disgusted by this infant, to I really want to care for this infant. I was still interested in what are those hormonal changes doing, and can we recapitulate those mechanisms in the absence of hormones? And then when I did my postdoc, I started working with mice because I was really interested in understanding molecular mechanisms, and I wanted to take advantage of transgenic tools and things like that. And so I switched to a mouse model, but mice are, you know, not small rats. They're completely different. And they, at least in the laboratory, they show something called spontaneous maternal behavior, where they don't really need to interact they don't need hormonal exposure in order to interact with infants. And I found this to be completely fascinating because it was sort of like I'd spent my whole graduate career trying to figure out how can we tweak the brain to get, you know, the onset of maternal care in the absence of hormonal changes. And now here was just a species that under laboratory conditions was doing this automatically. And so what I got really interested in was understanding how that process was taking place. And I think about hormones as really sort of speeding things up. Mm-hmm. And so you have this situation where in the context of these really changes that are occurring at birth, you're interacting with this infant stimulus and boom, within a very quick period of time, now you have plasticity, plastic changes that then allow mom to just continue to care for infants long after those hormonal changes have waned, because of course they wane very quickly. And so in the absence of any of those hormonal changes, thinking about mice that are just sort of spontaneously interacting with infants, I was interested in then, well, how do they become good moms? Like, how do they learn how to respond to infants and show all of these different caregiving behaviors? And I saw it as an opportunity to sort of see the process in a slow motion way. And so what I started doing was exposing these virgin female mice to pups every single day. And these are, of course, foster pups. And we can do this because fortunately, rats and mice don't really distinguish between their own offspring and foster offspring. So it's an easy paradigm to study. And, you know, what I found was they were really responding and improving in their care until, you know, a couple of days. And suddenly they were just as good as a postpartum female. And they could really, you know, obviously haven't looked at whether they would cross an electrified grid. That is not a 2020 type experiment. But, you know, they will go out into a novel environment, which is very fear-inducing for them. And they will retrieve pups and bring them back. And so they sort of recognize the needs of the infant is my interpretation of that. And so I got interested in, okay, well, then how is that happening in the brain? And that's really what led me to epigenetics because, again, my very adult, you know, I'm very, very focused on adulthood. And so when I think about epigenetics, I'm really thinking about these gene expression regulatory processes that are occurring in an experience dependent or to underlie experience dependent behavioral changes. And so, yeah, so I got interested in that, and we used some, you know, sort of drugs that enable us to manipulate epigenetic mechanisms in sort of a very broad and nonspecific way. But through that, I was able to show that we could reduce the amount of experience that moms would need. So we could sort of speed up the learning. And that makes sense because hormones like estradiol can exert effects in through epigenetic mechanisms, right? And so that was a big piece that I was always interested in, is sort of like, what is the final common pathway for these caregiving behaviors, and how can they be activated through these sort of different molecular mechanisms?
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? Right?
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. Just all the, because I think sometimes we forget all the factors that are playing a role. And we often are like, oh, it's hormones, hormones. We haven't found the data yet, but it's hormones. But then you're actually showing that, yeah, okay, it's other factors, of course. Hormones might speed this up, which I think is a great way to think about it, because I always think about it or talk about it as priming. So in a way, it's the same idea, but speed up the process. But the process is happening, like you said, in non-birthing parents. So what's going on? And then again, that piece about adulthood, right? Like the genetic expression with the epigenome, obviously that's like something you've shown as a key link. So very cool.
Yeah,
But
and I
I,
think,
yeah, go
oh,
ahead.
sorry. I was just going to say, I think that sort of like, I think that's the other piece that's so fascinating is the sustained care, right? So this sort of
Yeah.
once a mother, always a mother, that once you've had that experience, you sort of never go back to that original default state. And so.
Yeah. And that might be also good for people out there who are like, oh no, I'm having a second. Will I remember what I'm supposed to do? You do have skills. You have skills. The second will be different, but you've got more skills than you did with the first. But okay, fast forward to some of your more recent research. And so, I mean, we decided to talk about a specific paper you had with regards to modeling maternal mental illness. And this is, I'll say the title so everyone has it, but I'll put it in the show notes too. But it's called Ethologically Relevant Repeated Acute Social Stress Induces Maternal Neglect in Lactating Female Mouse. So, I mean, I guess the question is, I mean, tell us about the study, what the basis was for it.
So I think I was, you know, I as I've mentioned, I've been really interested in sort of what turns mothering on for most of my career. And I've always, you know, thought that that has implications for maybe what might be underlying maternal neglect or, you know, what might happen when mothering doesn't turn on properly. But I think what sort of led me to this question, of maybe more specifically addressing like what things might turn motherhood off is, you know, this same idea of plasticity, that we have this period of time right around birth where experiences can produce really long-lasting behavioral change in adulthood. And so I started to wonder, well, what happens if the experiences aren't positive? What happens if the experiences are negative? Is that one way that we might get, you know, longer term changes that maybe aren't positive for mom or for infant? So that was what led me to sort of get interested in it, in those questions. And of course, that has implications for peripartum mental health. So I started reading a lot more literature on humans, and I was really struck by how often people that are struggling with peripartum mental illness talk about the sort of disruption of bonding or the anxiety that is associated with interacting with infant. And often that can lead to sort of avoidance of infant, right? If you're afraid, like particularly I'm thinking about in cases of OCD where it's like, you know, intrusive thoughts that may be about harming the infant. And so maybe the idea is like, I'm just not really going to spend as much time with my infant. And that was something I hadn't really thought about, you know, a ton until I dove into that literature. And so I thought, like, how can we model this in our mouse model in such a way that we might ultimately be able to create something translational where we can use this mouse model to better understand both the neurobiology, but also maybe even use this model as a way to test potential pharmaceutical or other interventions. And so when I went to the literature, I started looking around. I realized that stress is a huge predictor of peripartum mental illness. You know, even can, I mean, obviously there are many risk factors, but even independently, stress and psychosocial stress is the sort of major point. So I wanted to create a mouse model that would really focus on that social stress piece. So that's how I started working on this project. And it can be very difficult to socially stress female rodents because they tend to be very pro-social and they get along well with other females. But there is, you know, this sort of whole body of literature on a behavior called maternal aggression or maternal defense, where during the postpartum period, when females are lactating, they will show aggressive behavior toward any male conspecific that they encounter. And of course, the reason for this is, you know, males are infanticidal towards infants if they haven't recently had a reproductive experience. And so moms have evolved this ability to defend their nests and keep their litters safe. And so lots of people have studied that and studied that behavior and the neural mechanisms underlying it. But what I didn't really find as much information on is sort of, you know, what I thought was the other side of that coin of like, okay, if you're defending your litter and you have to do it maybe a lot, that seems like it might be very stressful, socially stressful. And so I thought of that experience as maybe kind of a social threat. And so, you know, I was curious about whether or not if we had a repeated exposure to that social stressor, if that might cause some social anxiety and disrupt mother-infant interactions. And this, you know, of course, is really also very related to the primary model that we use to understand depression and anxiety in mice and in rats, which is the chronic social defeat model. And that model is exclusive to male rodents because males, of course, do fight with each other. And when you sort of force them to engage in that fight and they lose again and again, and then they sort of can smell and hear sensory inputs from this male that has sort of beaten them up again and again, this is very stressful. And we know that this produces all kinds of anxiety and depressive-like outcomes and dramatically changes the brain. And so I thought, this might be, you know, we've never been able to really use that model in females, at least, you know, under those conditions. And so I thought maybe we could actually sort of use that model in the postpartum period. And so that was sort of the setup and the design. And so we, so, and then I will say the other piece of what I really wanted to do with this model is I wanted space to study behaviors that might correlate well with the sorts of things that have been reported in the human literature. And so again, I really wanted to get at that sort of maternal avoidance piece. And I thought, well, it's hard to get at that because mouse cages are really tiny and mouse moms build these really big nests. And the nests are, you know, really almost half the size of the cage. And so usually when you're observing them, like if they get off the nest, they're just sort of eating or drinking. That's maybe what's on the other side of the cage, but they can't really like get away from their litter. And so I thought, what if we gave them a place to go to get away from their litter? Would they choose to go into this other area? So I built these sort of double wide mouse cages. So it's sort of two regular mouse cages, and I just drilled holes in them and then fitted a PVC pipe between the two. And they're identical, so they both have, you know, bedding and food and water. And the way I set the experiment up, moms give birth in their, in sort of one cage. So that's, the, you know, where they built their nest and everything. And then I attach this second cage, I think it's like 24 hours later, and that becomes the, you know, and so usually they don't move their nest. And so that's sort of the additional extra cage that they can explore. And so then we can really measure the amount of time that they're spending, not just with their litter, but the amount of time they're spending in each cage, because they really don't have a reason to go to this other cage other than wanting to be physically removed from their infants. And so I thought that might give us a chance to sort of explore this avoidance piece in a more direct way.
Now, I mean, in the study, you had control group, which was non-stressed, you had the stressed group, and then you had another group, which is rarely used, but super interesting, like the vicarious stress group, right?
Yes.
Can you, tell us about the reasoning behind that.
Yeah. So, you know, that was also happy accident, serendipitous, actually kind of a mistake on my part that ended up to be very interesting. So I have not studied stress really in my career. As I said, I'm always trying to make moms better. And so it didn't occur to me when I was setting the experiment up, you know, everything that happens to the experimental group happens to the control group, except for what you're manipulating. So I had, you know, my double housed cages, and I had my control animals, and I had my experimental animals. And I piloted this experiment several times because it was such a new kind of design. And so in one of the pilots, I had them just, you know, they were next to each other on the rack. And I noticed almost immediately that the control group was behaving exactly like the experimental group. And I knew it wasn't just the extra cage because I had also piloted whether or not they were going to be stressed out by this, you know, this additional cage. And as long as they were habituated to it, they were fine. So I thought, oh my gosh, could this be an, you know, could they be indirectly exposed to this stressor through maybe like olfactory cues or, you know, certainly ultrasonic vocalization sounds. So when I set up the real experiment, I decided that I was like, well, I want to test this and see if it's a real thing. And so we put the control animals in a completely separate test room. But then we kept some, you know, sort of control condition animals in the stress room. So in the vicarious group, the only thing they're really being exposed to is the same room that we're using for the stress animals. But other than that, they're not being exposed to any intruder males. And they have, you know, the exact same sort of experimental conditions that the control animals have. And in the control room, we also did include, just, you know, as an additional sort of precaution, breeders. So we had, so the control animals were not like completely alone in their room. They were in a room with other males and females that were breeding and producing litters, but there was just no sort of social stress aspect to what was happening in that particular room.
Yeah. So yeah, I think this is interesting, right? Because there's been a bit of research about like this vicarious stress, but not very much. And it makes me think, yeah, because they can't do anything about it if they're hearing it, right? Like it's really different. If you think about it as humans, it's a really different experience. Like it's a different type of stressor. So it's really interesting. So then what did you find?
So we found, I think, you know, our main finding was that both direct stress and this sort of indirect vicarious experience of stress can lead to disruptions in maternal behavior. And I think many behavioral outcomes that could be considered correlates of some of the things that we do see in people that are experiencing postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. So we found, and I should say we did the social stressor for 3 consecutive days. And then we tested 24 hours after the last stressor to see if we would get a sustained effect. So if you look across the 3 days, we're seeing, you know, reductions in nursing behavior. We're seeing reductions in licking and grooming of the offspring. We see more time spent sort of off the nest. And we did see, at least in the direct stress group, more time spent in that other cage. We only looked at their behavior for an hour after the stressor. So one of the things we've talked about doing in the future is doing some additional observations, maybe in the light cycle, which is their sort of nighttime. We also saw behaviors, I think, that are indicative of maybe an anxiety-like phenotype. So one of the really interesting things that we saw is this behavior we've called circling, where essentially when we put, so we, I should say, we take the pups out when we put the male intruder in for a couple of reasons. You know, we don't want the pups to get injured. Although to be fair, mom is pretty defensive, so it's unlikely that that would happen. But I also didn't want them to be directly exposed to the male because we would like to look at offspring development. Actually, that's what we're doing right now. So I didn't want them to have any direct exposure, but we take the male out, we put the pups back in. And usually what mom does, if she's, you know, not having an anxiety reaction, is she will pick each pup up and bring them back to the nest. And what we saw instead in the stress animals, the direct stress animals, is that they would pick the pup up, but they don't know where to go. It's almost like they just don't know how to handle the situation. And so they're sort of running around and sometimes even going back and forth between the, you know, the escape cage and their home cage. And eventually they'll drop the pups, sometimes in the nest, sometimes outside of the nest. But it almost seemed like a compulsive kind of behavioral response to like, I need to find safety, but I'm not exactly sure how to find safety. And similar to that, we saw that many of them would relocate their nest. So the stressor happens in their home cage and they are locked in their home cage during that. Most of the time they have access to both cages, but during the stressor, we close them off into their home cage. some of them, not all of them, but some of them will then move their, you know, their nest to the other cage, which of course makes perfect sense.
Right.
I was actually kind of expecting all of them to do that. And I found it to be really interesting that not all of them did that. And usually we only, if we saw them move a nest, they only did it once, which means that then the next time I put the male intruder into that cage, they didn't, there was maybe a bit of learned helplessness. They were like, okay, I'm not going to move to the other cage now because maybe this is following me no matter where I go. So I think those were some interesting behaviors that haven't really been described very well. We're currently running another experiment with the same paradigm. And in this experiment, we've seen something really interesting. I've taken some videos of it, which it's almost as though they treat the pups as though they're inanimate objects. And so they become so obsessed with sort of digging, which is an anxiety behavior, that if a, you know, if they're digging and a pup sort of falls close to them, so the pups are kind of just, you know, wiggling along, they can't really walk, they will literally just sort of fling the pup out of the way of what they're doing, like as though they're not, it's just like, I am focused on, fixated on this task and cannot have any disruption. So yeah, so I think overall we've uncovered some behaviors that I think are useful correlates. And I think it's also important to note that at the same time, they do still care for their infants. Their infants still gain weight. You know, there's no differences in the number of pups that survive. There isn't even any differences in weight between the two groups. Mm-hmm. So they are still nursing, right? They are still caring. So this isn't an example of severe abuse or neglect, which personally, I was very excited about because that's what I really wanted to model, something that is more like mental illness on the depressive or anxiety end than it would be something like, you know, psychosis or a more severe case of abuse. So yeah, so overall, the stress effects were much stronger for the direct group, but the vicarious group also did show many of these changes as well. And then some of these changes were sustained 24 hours after that last stressor. I'm really interested in like how long are these changes sustained, but of course, logistically, it gets challenging because the postpartum period is relatively short in terms of the time when like mom really has to be with pups all the time, right? So once the pups reach like, I don't know, 9 or 10 days, they're starting to walk on their own. They don't really need mom to be there as much. But I do have some plans to look at that sort of later postpartum period just to sort of get a sense of how much, I don't even know if we really know how much control moms even interact with infants at that time, because most of the time when we study maternal behavior in rodents, we're really looking at like the first week postpartum. So that'll be interesting to see. But yeah, my sense is that the effects are likely sustained, but or at least that's my hypothesis. Yeah. Yet to be proven, but
yet to be proven. Now, I mean, and what do you think is going on in the brain of these moms?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, you know, my career in terms of my focus has really been on the circuits that regulate maternal behavior very specifically. So I've been really interested in the medial preoptic area and the hypothalamus and how it interacts with the mesolimbic dopamine system. But as you know, there's also another neural system that regulates avoidance, right? So, and this was a big part of my graduate work, is trying to understand, you know, if the default state of most mammals is to avoid or ignore or maybe even attack infants, it makes sense that there's an entire neural system that responds to infant stimuli with those sort of negative behaviors. And one thing I've been really interested in is whether or not in these stressful situations, is there sort of just a lack of activation of these motivation or reward pathways, or is there also sort of this reignition of these pathways that are actually involved in infant avoidance. And in mice, this is super interesting to me because they're, at least in the lab, they're not by default ignoring or avoiding, right? And so it's almost like, could this be a latent pathway that would not normally be activated, but could be under certain circumstances? So those are sort of the two main pathways that I've explored that I'm interested in. But I think considering the sort of anxiety and depression angle, that sort of pulls me more into prefrontal cortex and hippocampus. And of course, we do know, you know, there's beautiful literature showing HPA axis dysregulation. Probably the best, you know, understanding that we have of what's happening during the late postpartum or late gestation and early postpartum period is this sort of plasticity and GABA receptors that if it doesn't go properly, we end up with this really hyperactive HPA axis. So that's also an interesting component of this as well. So yeah, I haven't done any brain work in this model yet. So I think there's lots of interesting questions. Yeah,
but you're going to do brain work in it, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
I mean, we've talked briefly about non-birthing parents, right? Because many of them also struggle with perinatal mental illness. And I'm wondering, like, what are your thoughts on developing some sort of model in a biparental species for the non-birthing parent, because I think it would be really interesting to see that maybe sex difference even, right? In how these systems or how these factors are impacting the parent.
Yeah, absolutely. Know.
I mean, do you think it would work, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say is I think this exact sort of idea is why I was so excited about the vicarious stress finding, right? And so I think even just thinking about my mouse model, which is uniparental, where only moms are involved, I can talk about that in a second. I do have some work with males. But I think that the vicarious model is exciting to me because it means I can look at virgin females and I can see whether or not they would be disrupted by this vicarious stress. They're not going to show a defense response because they're not lactating. But if they're susceptible to a vicarious stress experience, then we can sort of take pregnancy and, you know, lactation out of the picture and still ask the same questions about whether or not plasticity, which we know from my former work, is ramped up during these early interactions with infant, whether or not that in and of itself, even in the absence of hormones, might lead to a greater susceptibility or risk or vulnerability for these mental, these changes that may have implications for mental illness. So that piece I'm very excited about. In terms of dads, mice are uniparental, but in the laboratory, males will show caregiving behavior. So I have done some work with males because it's very interesting to me. Like they will show maternal care, but they will never be as good as a female. And so that piece just generally has always been very interesting to me. In terms of thinking about,
I mean, I'm going to say, because this is also interesting because with laboratory rodents are quite different than wild rodents.
Oh, absolutely.
You see this, I have a colleague here. He's like, oh, I leave the male and female rats together when there's pups because the males are parenting as well. And I'm like, but we've all been taught, no, this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I think somehow we've developed these, you know, a little bit different rodents when we have these laboratory animals. But that being said, also super interesting then, because something shifted for them so that they act like they're non-avoidant or they're not aggressive towards offspring. But
to me, I think it's still all about the experience, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, a huge fascinating question that we do not understand is this sort of on and off infanticide mechanism in males. So, which I'm also very fascinated with. So males, once they give birth, once they give birth, they're not giving birth. Yeah. Once they mate, it's what I meant.
Yeah.
So once they mate, they're not infanticidal, but that takes a couple weeks to emerge, right? Because the idea is you'd want to have a protective mechanism in place that they're not killing their own offspring. And of course, the reason that they want to kill pups is so that the female will go back into estrus and they can mate with her. We've done a little bit of pilot with this. So if they have, you know, sex experience, it takes about 2 weeks before we start to see some of them respond to infants, but really by 21 days, which is around just birth, they're not infanticidal. If you expose them to pups at that time, they're not infanticidal. And so presumably you know, those neural mechanisms that would be regulating aggressive behavior are turned off. And that makes me think that the infants then can access these, again, latent circuits that would not otherwise ever be activated, but probably are conserved. And that produces these caregiving behaviors. Why those behaviors can never really reach the level of the female, I think, is a fascinating question and could be associated like differences in chromatin accessibility and like what gene expression changes can happen. I mean, those are some of my ideas, but you know, the thing that I find really the most fascinating about this is I'm not sure that this isn't also related to what happens in biparental mammalian species, right? So it's very rare for mammals to show biparental care. I think it's like less than 5% of mammalian species show biparental care. And in those species, what the dads are doing is usually just exactly the same thing as what the moms are doing. It's not as though they're providing a unique or different sort of approach. And it's usually this biparental care is associated with like some sort of need, right? So maybe there's like, you know, I'm thinking about with the meadow voles and the prairie voles, like there are different environmental conditions in which similar species will may need to evolve this biparental care in order to, you know, have the best reproductive outcomes. And so I don't necessarily see them as being completely different in terms of what we've generated in the laboratory, but yeah, I think these are really interesting questions. And I think in some ways hard to ask in my mind in biparental species, because I think that I guess you would need to stress both mom and dad and sort of see how that works. I know moms can provide so much compensatory care that I think that even in biparental species, if you take the dad out, it's not to say there aren't negative consequences, but mom can provide a lot of compensation without dad.
Yeah, because she can lactate. That's exactly that thing dad's missing, right? So
Then, right, you can't really take mom out and just see what dad would do because he's not actually capable, unless you had a model where you were able to like, you know, artificially feed them or something like this.
Yeah. But that adds in all sorts of variables. In the lab, for sure.
Right, in the laboratory.
We don't have baby bottles for mice and rats. And formula, unfortunately, it's just not readily available.
I feel like we should make like a vest for the males and like
put gosh.
Like, is that a future experiment?
That would be so great. Although no one would like support financially the building of
Nobody would pay for that experiment.
You know. But it's a great idea. That's so funny. That's a good one. So, I mean, that being said, I mean, what's going on in research-wise for you right now?
Yeah. So I'm just really enjoying working with this model because I think it has so much potential for addressing so many important questions. So I told you a little bit about the brain stuff that I want to do, but I also think another really important aspect that I'm seeing as a future direction is using the model as a way to really test interventions. And I think what's important about this is we have the combination of not only the sort of hormonal changes that we know are important for understanding mental illness in the reproductive period, which also could have implications for other dramatic hormonal changes in a lifespan. But I also think then the stress piece we already know is really important. So we know that hormones can do all kinds of things that can affect our neural systems, but we also know stress can do all kinds of things that can affect our neural systems. And I think as we uncover, you know, particularly in the sort of world of transcriptomics, as we sort of uncover these global changes that are occurring as a result of maybe hormone exposure and stress exposure, I think we're starting to really understand whether or not certain interventions will work if stress was involved in the situation or they won't. And so, for example, there's been some work looking at like early life stress and then responses in adulthood to SSRI treatments. Finding that like, okay, if there's a depressive like phenotype in adulthood, the SSRI treatment may be useful. But if there was also an early life stress or an early life adversity factor, then we don't see the same level of effectiveness for the SSRI. And so I think it's sort of may help us to tease apart what can work and what, and you know, importantly, whether or not it can work if the condition was maybe brought on by stress. So that I'm really excited about. I'm also really excited about using this as a way to address one of, I think, the really important questions that's not commonly addressed, which is if we're looking at a pharmaceutical intervention, how does it affect mom's behavior? How does it affect offspring outcomes? How does it affect breast milk? And whether or not there's, you know, any safety or efficacy issues when we look at sort of all three components. And so I'm interested in using the model to sort of get at those questions too.
Yeah. On a side note, I mean, I've done a lot of perinatal SSRI work, right? And so, I mean, it's always been an interesting field of study because I think we come at it with a lot of bias in many ways. But the piece that we are lacking very much so is understanding how these medications, excuse me, actually affect moms. Because in my dream world, it would be, here's the SSRI for you. Because we know that this one works because of your symptom cluster and profile and because of these other factors, whatever. So here it is for you and you will be well, right? And, exactly, you know, right. And I think that we are really lacking that piece of the literature, because I think, I mean, we do know if mom's doing quite well, then usually everyone is doing quite well, right? Developmentally. And so that's where I think we do need more of like models to really figure out what's going on. So yay. Oh,
yeah, no, I also find it to be shocking how many papers just never look at maternal behavior as their studies, right?
So or at like, female offspring.
Right.
It is shocking that, they don't look at just like some core components.
Right. And so, yeah, so we really missed that piece of like, but did the drug affect, you know, did it improve mom's interactions with infants? And we just completely missed that piece. So
yeah. And I think we're missing, like, we miss this in the clinical literature as well, is it working? Like, you know, we don't really divide the groups into working, like SSRI, no depression, SSRI depression, depression, no SSRI kind of thing. Like, we have to start moving forward. Some people have, but I think it's a really big piece of the puzzle. There's much to be done, but I think we also need to, you know, sometimes I think on top of all the research funding that goes to these studies that don't tell us what they think they tell us, we could use so much money to support parents because we know what can be really helpful for their mental health, right? But we're not doing that either. Anyway, bigger issue. But that being said, tell me about this 51 Foundation that you've started, because I mean, this kind of plays into the need to actually, well, support women.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I think all of the, everything that we've been talking about, these are so important. These questions are so important and they've been, you know, largely unanswered. And it's really difficult to do research in this. It's really difficult to get money. That's why it's difficult to do research in this field, particularly if you are interested in mom. And I think if you're doing anything that's related to women's health in general, it's very, very difficult to get funding. There has not been a lot of money available for this kind of work through NIH, where most of us are receiving our grants. If you look at almost any women's health research topic, it could be menopause, it could be like Alzheimer's and menopause, right? The single institute that funds all of these things is NICHD, National Institutes of Child Health and Development, which I think really says a lot about the way that we perceive this research and our funding priorities. And yet at the same time, as we learn about sex differences that do exist, which are associated with sex hormones or sex chromosomes, it becomes more and more clear that relatively small differences, for example, I'm thinking about X chromosome inactivation, right? So we have this dosage compensation mechanism because the X chromosome contains so many genes that are important for, all kinds of non-reproductive sorts of mechanisms. And there are some, and so we have this dosage compensation mechanism in which 1X is essentially inactivated, but there are a relatively small, like handful of genes that escape X chromosome inactivation. And those genes are global regulators of our genome and involved in epigenetic processes, right? And then similarly, hormones, they produce their effects by regulating gene transcription. So we have these, you know, what maybe seem to some people like small differences, but they can result in huge biological differences. There was just a paper that came out showing there's sex differences in the blood-brain barrier, which has like huge implications for, you know, pharmaceutical treatments. And then at the same time, our entire body of knowledge that we work with in the scientific community is based on the male brain and the male body. And so we just have not had evidence-based healthcare for women essentially ever. And this is why, you know, there's like, sex is listed as the number one risk for adverse reaction to a medication across every single category. 1/3 of prescription medications have never been tested in 51% of the population. So, and it's funny because I keep hearing this on the news as Biden has announced this amazing initiative that, you know, women are more than half of the population. And so that's how 51 Foundation was born. I was really frustrated several years ago. I had submitted a grant with a new collaborator and colleague. She's a psychiatrist, and she's really interested in understanding pregnancy as a protective mechanism for substance use disorders. So she had found some data that pregnancy naturally reduces substance use. And it happens really early on, maybe even before folks realize that they're pregnant, and there's some animal research to back this up. And so we wanted to explore this. And, you know, we actually wanted to ultimately study male and female mice because we wanted to sort of, you know, understand the sex differences. But we decided like, okay, hold ourselves back. We're going to write this first grant. It's all going to be about female mice and just understanding the neurobiology of the mechanism. And, you know, you never get funded on the first go, so that's not a big deal. But we got this grant reviewer who just said it's unclear how this work is applicable to the broader population, and then literally wrote, for example, men. And I think that just, you know, it was COVID, it was 2020. I had a lot of time to think.
Wow.
And that just, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back for me. You know, I've been in this field for a long time, and I've always known that you have to be an outstanding scientist in order to be able to get funded in this field because there's so little money. And when I read that comment, I just felt furious, hopeless, you know, all the emotions. And I started to think like, okay, well, what do other people do who are studying something that is not considered mainstream to the scientific community? And so I had, you know, a colleague who studies rare disorders, and most of her funding, you know, these are disorders that affect less than 1% of the population. And most of her funding comes from private sources. And so I thought like, maybe there's some private funding, and I'm Googling, and there really wasn't. And so that was sort of how this project was born. The idea was to dedicate money to women's health so that we never have to ask questions about whether or not it matters that we study something that is considered like, does this have scientific merit, or does this belong to a, you know, a tiny subfield that actually represents most of the the majority of the population? And so that's where we started. But I think, you know, through the project, through building the foundation, I've learned so many things. I've been exposed to all kinds of really interesting and different types of research. And I think our goals are not only to provide money, but also to sort of scaffold projects, you know, to sort of help develop tools that would be useful for women's health research, to connect scientists that maybe wouldn't otherwise interact, to connect not only scientists within fields, but across fields, and think about the role of technology and how that might be useful in some of the things that we need to do. One of the things that we're working on right now is building an accountability metric so that we can actually track the progress that things like the Biden administration's initiative will have. So, you know, there's been a ton of folks in our field quantifying the inequity in scientific research. So we know, you know, that even though the NIH has addressed you know, we need to include males and females in rodent studies. And they've addressed that that sex and gender need to be part of the analyses, even if you're doing, or if you're doing research with humans. We know that most of our scientific research is not compliant. And we also know that, you know, the higher impact research in particular tends to be really focused on males or really not looking at those sex differences. And so what we want to be able to do is sort of track that in a way that is much more widespread so that we can see where we are at right now and also where we will be moving to, or whether or not we're really making the progress that we think we're making. So we've got some sort of side projects like that that we're excited about too. And facilitating data sharing and data curation, and those kinds of things. But yeah,
that's great.
What we've been working on.
It's exciting. Good for you.
Questions, comments, suggestions, get in touch at Mommy Brain Revisited on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. You can also contact me on my website at jodipaluski.com. That's JODIPAWLUSKI.com. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Stripe.